right, friends, Greg Kokel here, and the show, of course, is Stand to Reason. I am so glad to be with you today, especially this first hour, because I've got a friend, a buddy on board that that is in a unique position to observe the impact of ideas on our culture right now. And I actually planned to just chat about 20 minutes with him at the front end. But after I've read some of the things he's written and some of his experiences, we'll probably take a little bit more time. He's a guy who goes way back with me to my MA Phil days at Talbot. His name's Richard Bordner, and he actually hosted me at Ohio State University, where he was a student and also on the wrestling team. I got that right. All right, Rich?
Yep.
Yeah, you're a wrestler there. And then I ended up hosting him at my house because he was checking out the program. Is that right? You came out for a few days, and it was right at 9/11, and you got grounded.
Yep, exactly.
And so I said, come on down, and he stayed at my house for a few days until planes got up again, and it was really nice to have you there, Rich.
Yeah, that was a huge privilege.
Yeah, it was really cool the way it worked out. And then he came to the program, and then we had some classes together and stuff, and I took like 13 years to finish the program. I think he finished it sooner than in less time than I did, at least.
Not
you
by
might
much.
Have gotten out of it before I got out of it myself. I don't know. I graduated
in
2006.
Okay, 2013.
Oh, okay. So you were okay. You were there. You were kind of like me.
Yep.
It took a long time to get through the program. In any event, here's what's important for you folks listening in is that Rich has been working in a secular educational environment and working with, especially with young people. And you know that I've said this many times, that the most important generation is always the next generation. It's always critical for us to be able to pass the baton to the next generation, just like it's been passed down for 2,000 years. And we carry it now. We got to pass to the next generation. And of course, our what we now call reality conferences have been our way of doing that, in addition to the broad-based things we do at Stand to Reason, but having the focus there to communicate. But, you know, Rich, when we planned this, I got your letter, your note, and then your notes. Your first note saying we want to talk a little bit if we can, and then your notes that you sent me, which were extensive, your own thoughts. I got to say it was somewhat chilling to read your observations, even though everything that you said was completely consistent with things I'm reading in works like The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self by Carl Truman and Live Not by Lies by Rod Dreher, and these are ones that you're familiar with as well. Maybe we'll start this out just by having you kind of give us a little short bio, like where you are and what the kind of thing you're doing, and then we'll get into what's going on in the heads of the students that you're dealing with, and that's really the world of ideas stuff that forms behavior that we want to talk about.
Sure. So I've been a public school teacher now for 15 years. I started out first 3 years in California in Compton. And then I taught for 9 years in a Orange County town called Mission Viejo, where I also coached wrestling. And then I've been here in North Dallas, Texas for the last 3 years. And so I teach English. And when I moved to Texas, I also started teaching a philosophy class, which is a lot of fun.
By the way, I'm just thinking, you went from Compton to Mission Viejo. For people who are not familiar with Southern California, that is a huge cultural jump. And then go from Mission Viejo to Texas.
Yeah.
There's another cultural jump. The only reason I mention that is because you have experience now with different slices of American culture. And so your observations are not just parochial or you're not just kind of locked into a little burg somewhere, but you have a broad-based understanding of provincial is the word I was looking for. But good.
You know, one thing that struck me over the years is, there's some differences, but there's an awful lot of similarities, too, in terms of how the kids think and how the kids behave. And, you know, you'll find wonderful students in any sort of environment, no matter where you go. And so I've been blessed to be to teach some really good students that I've enjoyed and to rub shoulders with some excellent faculty, and I've been blessed mm-hmm. to have great administrators all through the line. So, yeah, that I've been fortunate. I don't think everybody is as fortunate as I've been.
Mm-hmm.
So to kind of finish the bio, I've been doing that for 15 years, and then recently I started kind of a side ministry called Daniel Collaborative, which does a lot of things, but mainly it does role play trainings like some of your STR staff guys do,
mm-hmm.
guys like Brett Kunkel.
So you play the atheist,
yep.
and you put the young people through their paces, and usually that's not a very pretty picture.
It's fun though.
Fun for you.
Yeah, because I get to mess with them. So, it's been so far for the students, it's been really impactful for them because it is a good wake up call, and they're very open to being coached and learn and to be motivated in that way. So yeah, it's been fun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what really grabbed me is how you described the thinking of your students, and as it turns out, the things that you described for me and what you sent me was not like, here's where these awful secular people are, you know, doing all mm-hmm. these nasty non-Christian things. I mean, for one, that's not your spirit, obviously, but it wasn't even the substance. It was almost what you said is that, like, as evangelicals, sometimes we're focusing in on what turns out to be symptoms when there's an underlying mm-hmm. element, an underlying way of understanding the world that is driving these symptoms, and oftentimes we miss that. And I'll tell you, I haven't missed the underlying worldview in terms of the nature of it. I have missed the gravity of it, the thoroughgoing, all-consuming kind of mm-hmm. Nature of it, at least the way you describe it here. So what I'd like you to do is just go from there, use that as a springboard, Rich, and talk about the kind of ideas the students are embracing and how they are embracing them. And you broke it down in some different categories, but why don't you, the piece you sent me, but why don't mm-hmm. you start with that and give
sure.
us the kind of understanding you offered me in your piece.
Yeah, so first I just got to offer a caveat because anything I say is, of course, a generalization. There's always exceptions. You can find them anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Students can be surprising in pleasant ways and not so pleasant ways. You know, they're teenagers, literally missing parts of their brain. So it tends to be never a dull day. So there's always generalizations. And, you know, on the positive side, I do notice a hunger and an interest to talk about deep things.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of people that I've read and I've listened to note that they sense a kind of apathy.
Right.
I really haven't. The students in my classes love talking about this stuff. They willingly jump in. So far, emphasis on the word so far, they've been really mature about it. You know, a lot of these topics that we discuss in my philosophy class, you know, that the class is meant to be provocative. That's how it's
mm-hmm.
built. And when I go promote it, I tell them that up front, like, hey, you're signing up for a class where there's going to be hot button topics talked about every week.
Mm-hmm.
And so far they've handled it really well. There's almost
been civil.
Yeah. So no evergreen state style meltdowns or anything like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. I wonder, by the way, if that's because as I read through your illustrations, your anecdotes and stuff, your engagement mm-hmm. with the students, I mean, you are very deft in navigating conversations, and I'm wondering if that, and plus there's evidence of the tactical approach and asking the right questions mm-hmm. in a provocative way, and I'm wondering if that has been a factor in the apathy equation here, because I do hear this all the time. Oh, people don't care; they're so apathetic, mm-hmm. and I'm just wondering, self reflecting here for you, do you think maybe that your style as an instructor here might be a factor because you're not just, you know, pounding the podium mm-hmm. and just, you know, what do you think?
I hope, you know, because that would mean that I'm doing something right.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, it's kind of hard to tell because I don't get out of my classroom a whole lot to observe other teachers' classrooms. So I don't know, although I did do a little bit of that my first year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my style tends to be very Socratic before we have any sort of dialogue or any sort of discussion, which, you know, we have discussions multiple times a week for pretty much the whole period.
Mm-hmm.
I'll sit down and I'll try to script it out. So I'll, you know, you've taught me the Columbo tactic really well, and I've imbibed that lesson. And so I try to just to write down the questions and what I think the response is going to be and kind of what question I'm going to ask next. Not in any sort of indoctrinating way, but just in a way to push them in the right places, you know, to get them to think deeply about things that matter. And, you know, I would like to think that after 15 years of practice that I'm, you know, okay at it. I still have far to go, but yeah.
But so you've got young people that are willing to engage and in a civil fashion, but it's what you learned about the way they think about things that is striking to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a lot of variance, but there's like four or five general themes that are very, very, very common, almost universal. And this is describing not just your secular-minded kids, but your Christian kids. Not just the Christian kids, but the strong Christian kids. You know, the kids that go to youth group every week, that are raised in Christian homes. The first is that there's, here's how I put it, especially in terms of morality, there's a lot of what I call worldview salad. And it's just kind of like a, I don't mean to be pejorative, but it's kind of like a jumbled mess up there. A lot of contradictory beliefs they're trying to hold together.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's because they don't talk about this stuff very often. You know, usually what they're focused on with their families is, you know, soccer practice, boyfriend, girlfriend, getting into college, kind of climbing the success ladder, planning for their career. And the deep things, if they do come up, they're kind of relativized, you know, like kind of mm-hmm. like an ice cream flavor. And mm-hmm. so they just don't have a lot of stamina and experience thinking through fundamental worldview issues. So mm-hmm. that's one theme. And then, you know, if you want me to give you stories, I got stories for each one of these principles. Like there's almost a story every day. So there's that. And then they're very, very, very highly super duper individualistic and not in a healthy way. They're highly conformist at the same time. You kind of might wonder, like, how could they be individualistic and conformist at the same time?
Mm-hmm.
But those,
yeah.
those two go together very well if you think about it. Mm-hmm. And then they're shaped by screens thoroughly. That's kind of like almost their primary discipler, if you put it that way. And they're lastly highly dogmatic. So again, there's exceptions, but these are some consistent themes in what I've noticed in our class discussions. And you know, I see
okay,
these
so
themes.
Okay, so you started out by saying like they're really scattered. You use the word salad, and it's just kind of like a hodgepodge of things, which means they are not thinking critically about their worldview. Is that because they're simply absorbing a worldview from they're being socialized to a certain way of thinking?
Mm-hmm.
Is that why they don't come to conclusions about things? They just accept ideas
right.
that are
right. And you know, in their defense, I think it's that way with every generation to a certain extent, but it's that way with the current generation, current young students, simply because it's been dialed up to an 11 through screen technology. And it's the culture is so, so, so immersive. It's like hopped up on roids with everything you could think of. You know, we would just get our culture from, you know, in terms of screens and digital technology, just from TV, you know, CBS, NBC, the top four channels. For them, it's so much more immersive. And so it reaches them to a different degree and more quantity as well. And I mm-hmm. think that's one reason why.
So this last year has just aggravated that because
oh, yeah.
the COVID
totally.
Has driven everybody indoors and right onto their screens.
Yeah.
It's their only escape to the outside world in many ways.
Yeah. And you know, ironically, I think that might be one reason why students like discussing this stuff so much now, at least in my experience, because mm-hmm. I don't think this is just my school. I think this is somewhat widespread. I don't think there's a whole lot of interaction that students are getting. You know, they're not getting a whole lot of engagement and a whole lot of interaction. At least that's what they tell me when I talk to them and when I, you know, give them anonymous surveys, kind of taking their temperature.
Right.
They say, you know, we don't really talk to people a whole lot anymore in our classes. It's just kind of like this eerie quiet. And so when they get an opportunity to discuss and to interact socially with them, you know, their classmates and a teacher, like they're just lapping it up and they just love it. So
right, they're lonely out there, kind of.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
gives them access. So okay, so you that's the scattered part,
mm-hmm.
But then you talk about this really aggressive individualism,
mm-hmm.
and that's the one that interests me the most. There's a conformity we'll talk about too, but I think that. I mean, the conformity has to do with the commitment to this doctrine of individualism and the kind of the triumph of the self, so to speak. So talk about that. Tell us, unpack that for us a little bit, because this is, like I said, this is the part that really got my attention.
Mm-hmm.
The degree to which young people are sold out to this particular idea
mm-hmm.
that some have called expressive individualism.
Right. So, again, to start kind of going back, I really love and care for my students. So I don't want to, put too much on them. So first, just an element of defense. The students think this way because we think this way, like the adults. Like we've set up this culture for them. Sometimes unknowingly or unwittingly, but they didn't create this culture. They just kind of find themselves in it. So, they're very individualistic and kind of like I have two ways that I like two senses of individualism. So the first is like a healthy individualism, the individualism of like Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from Birmingham Jail.
Mm-hmm.
The law above the law. Martin Luther's refusal to recant,
mm-hmm.
the individual that keeps his head while everyone else around him is losing theirs, you know, that sort of individualism. That's not what I'm talking about.
The willingness to stand against the crowd for the right reasons.
Right, right. You mentioned Carl Truman. He's kind of put his finger on this recently. Rod Dreher's another guy. Alan Jacobs is another guy. They all term it, they all call it a different name. So Alan Jacobs calls it metaphysical capitalism. Truman calls it expressive individualism, but it's all kind of the same idea that they embrace as axiomatic the idea that I am my own. I define myself, period, full stop. Nothing else defines you but you. And here's how Alan Jacobs puts it. He says, I am a commodity wholly owned and operated by myself in service to my own interests as defined by me. Therefore, the socio-political order is to be evaluated strictly in terms of whether it helps or hinders my autonomy. And then secondly, they hold that meaning or purpose or anything like that, value, is to be found just by looking inward, not by looking upward or looking out to a community. Like, they define the meaning for themselves, and that is it.
It's like you be you.
Exactly.
There's that that slogan.
Yeah, and the authenticity comes from expressing what is inside you fully and being unhindered in that. So if there's some sort of limit to your self-expression, that is to be avoided unless you want to choose that. So
mm-hmm.
choice is kind of the sacred, if you can put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And This message is everywhere. It's not just schools, but it's churches too. It's in the home. It's Disney. Mm-hmm. This generation, my daughter's generation, my generation, like we were all raised on Disney movies, and this is pretty much the worldview fundamentally of almost every Disney movie that I can think of. Even the family friendly ones like Frozen and The Incredibles. They're all variations of kind of the same idea. Like there's this beleaguered and put upon individual who has desires and interests and dreams that are kind of out of step with the larger society. Sometimes that larger society is their family. Sometimes it's their town. Sometimes it's, just society writ large. And so the whole movie is their journey of liberation from that, liberation from the traditional expectations and categories of others, and to where they get to fully express themselves. And then on the flip side, the larger society's gradual awakening to the need to let mm-hmm. go of that and let go of their limiting notions and accept the protagonist's kind of unique identity. And that's
mm-hmm.
that's pretty much every Disney movie out there. If you think of,
right.
I don't want to be cheesy, but think of the song "Let It Go" from Frozen. If you actually read the lyrics in that song, that's expressive individualism all the way down. Let me just read one stanza. The fears that once controlled me can't get to me at all. It's time to see what I can do, to test the limits and break through. No right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free.
Mm.
And that's just one stanza. The whole song is like that.
You know, I remember that song. I actually saw the movie with my daughter, and she wanted to take her whole group of friends for her birthday when she was like 10 or whatever it was, you know, school friends. And that's the way we had her birthday party. And when I heard that song, it really, really bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's interesting about that movie, there's, you know, no right, no wrong. It's just me. I'm free. I'm freeing myself of all of that. The movie seems to develop a little bit towards the end, like she made the wrong choice. That's what got everything frozen. And then you got to get unfrozen and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a kind of a, you know, like that didn't work out so well. But what it strikes me is what people remember about the movie is the song,
mm-hmm.
and what the song communicated. And it does capture this idea that people have now that what matters is what I want. It's what I believe. It's mm-hmm. what I think. It's not anything out there. You mentioned it's not the community. This is really odd because, you know, when postmodernism started to rise up in our consciousness, so to speak, community was a factor there. I mean, community mm-hmm. was important because it's kind of a community-based relativism of sort, you know, how your linguistic community cashes out different things, and so we're all together. But this breaks people down. It atomizes culture into all individuals. And so the only culture you end up with is a culture of people that are committed to themselves and not the culture. The mm-hmm. only thing that's similar is their commitment to this idea, right. Which strikes me as it's going to be kind of cannibalistic in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It fights against it. And so, I mean, do you see that tension that I'm talking about?
Yeah, well, I mean, you put it in a lot of your talks on relativism that no one's ever truly a relativist.
Right.
So, you know, when they're defending turf, they have these relativistic ideas, but when they're, you know, not doing that, their moral intuitions that are there, you know, mm-hmm. kind of rise up. And so, yeah, there is that kind of tension with this as well. They're not, like, no one in my classes that I've ever met is truly an individual, because then they'd be a sociopath. But they have imbibed these views to a certain extent
mm-hmm.
that helps them to kind of keep the deep things at bay, anything that would limit their autonomy,
mm-hmm.
and keeps them from really putting two and two together and thinking through these ideas at the next level.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's how.
So they don't realize that the views that they're passionately pursuing, that they're deeply committed to this expressive individualism. I'm the master of my own fate. What matters is me realizing what I want at any
mm-hmm.
given time,
mm-hmm.
and that message is, like you said, reinforced everywhere they turn.
Right.
It seems to me they are not thinking when. That if everybody lives that way, this is going to interfere with their own ability to express themselves individually, because somebody
mm-hmm.
with more power with a different agenda can intrude, and that
mm-hmm.
that kind of potential conflict doesn't occur to them.
Yeah, that kind of comes back to the worldview salad. You know, they'll have these individualistic ideas, but then they'll also have, you know, very rosy ideas about the collective good and wanting to kind of all come together and that sort of thing. And they don't really notice how that doesn't work well together.
Yeah. So this helps explain then the sense of, I'm trying to think of the right word here. What comes to mind is ennui, which is like boredom, about the ethics of sex and sexuality and gender and all that. It's for this crowd. It's like, what's the big deal? They're living, to follow your characterization here, they're expressing their own individualism. That's the basic rule there. If somebody wants to live this way or think they are this way, if they want to self-identify as a different gender or no gender at all, for example,
mm-hmm.
or if they have sexual desires that are not conventional to the old way, what does it matter? Because
yeah.
the new way is expressing their individual preferences, and that's the thing that matters.
Yeah, I think that's something that a lot of people in church and Christian circles have missed. I think we address these issues on kind of like a downstream, not the most fundamental level. And so we address issues of, say, like you just mentioned, sexuality or whatever issue you want to throw in there, as like mainly on the moral level. You know, so is same-sex marriage right or wrong? Is this sexual behavior right or wrong? Or we'll address it on the public policy level. You know, like, our, you know, what should we do about bathroom policies and gender division in sports, things, preferred pronouns, what have you. But we fail to see that all of those are really downstream from this kind of expressive individualism view. So if it's not just a like a more morally permissible atmosphere or being more inclusive, it's a whole worldview shift of anthropology mm-hmm. and metaphysics. Mm-hmm. And so if an individual or a church or a family or culture, what have you, adopts this expressive individualism that, you know, mm-hmm. Truman talks about, for example, everything else in the sexual revolution follows. Mm-hmm. Like everything else, it's a done deal.
Well, it's just because it's an open door. What matters yeah. is not any particular, the nature of any particular choice, because there's nothing outside the individual that appropriately judges the choice, mm-hmm. but rather it is just simply that a person is allowed to make the choice themselves, because yeah, that is the summum bonum. That is the greatest good.
Yeah, you call the shots yourself, and the only limits that are morally acceptable limits are the ones that you choose for yourself. And students, you know, kids really don't put it that way, but if you kind of really think about how they describe their views and where they're coming from, that's kind of, at the end of the day, that's the summary of their view, mm-hmm. you know.
I think one anecdote that I read in your piece is that, and you can tell us about this because what you've already suggested, but I want to just lay it out there on the table. Is there really, you have not really found any significant difference in this fundamental core view of reality between the secular kids and the Christian kids, even the Christian kids that have all the external trappings of good, noble Christian behavior and practices, et cetera, like mm-hmm. you mentioned, youth group, church, worship, and all that.
Right.
And then you talked about the young man who said, I love Jesus with all of my heart, and then there was an issue that came mm-hmm. up regarding abortion. Tell us that story.
Yeah, so this is in my philosophy class. And again, that class, we tackle all of the controversial issues that you could think about that are like the hot button ones today, and I do that because I think students like that and I think they need that. So mm-hmm. anyway, so that was context. So we watched a debate on abortion and read some things pro con, and then we were having a class discussion on it. And I was just kind of listening to the students talk in their own little small groups. And this is a kid who first day of class, I have them write a letter to me and say, "Hey, what do you want me to know about you? You know, anything at all." It's a private letter. And he writes that, you know, he absolutely loves Jesus with all his heart. He wants to make him known. He identifies as a evangelical Christian, and like that's kind of like core to his identity, right? And then I was listening to his group talk, and he goes, "Well, you know, I'm pro-life and all, but I would never ever think of you know, telling a woman what to do with her body or limiting her autonomy or anything like that. I would never be able to tell her what choice to make."
Hmm.
And so this was not before watching the debate. This was after. So they had already been exposed to, you know, not just the pro-choice side, but the pro-life side and you know, a really good description of the pro-life side. And so he was still kind of just dogmatically, you know, putting his feet down in the individualism.
So in other words, that's it. He was deeply committed. He was more committed to this expressive individualism mm-hmm. as a general rule, not just for himself, but for other people, mm-hmm. that he could not bring himself, even if he believed the pro-life view. I mean, I'm presuming this is part of the backstory here. Even if he was persuaded by the pro-life view, this is not relevant, because that's the most important question isn't whether a human being is losing their life, but most important question is whether another human being gets to choose what they want to choose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Am I reading that right?
Yeah, yeah. So, I think the point here isn't that viewpoint is rare, because, you know, you have a lot of discussions with people about abortion, some of which are pro-choicers, and I do. And so, you know, we hear this kind of modified pro-choice view espoused all the time. I think the salient point here is what it's like, where it comes from. It comes from this metaphysical capitalism, expressive individualism, what have mm-hmm. you, view. Like I said, if that piece is in place, everything else follows. And this is, you know, this is a kid that's been raised in the church. And, you know, it wasn't like I was shocked or surprised, but just kind of connecting the dots.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And one more thing, if I could jump in there. Maybe there was some kabuki theater going on here. Like, I think kids...
I don't know what that is, by the way.
It just kind of like, you know, you understand that this is what the smart people say, this is what the smart people believe, and so you just kind of like say it.
Oh, I see.
So you put on a performance. Yeah, you put on a performance. I don't know why he said there. I don't know why, you know, I can't read students' minds ultimately. I just know what they say. So maybe there's a little bit of, like, they just kind of tacitly understand, even though nobody explicitly says it, that, you know, this is what the smart people believe. This is what kind of the view that the elites have. This is how everybody in the inner circle thinks, you know, if you think about C.S. Lewis's essay. So I want in that inner circle. I want their approval because I think they're smart. So I'm going to kind of say the same things. I'm going to adopt their views because I want to go along to get along. I think there's a lot of that going on, too.
Yeah, and that's, of course, adults do the same thing here.
Oh, right, right. Everybody
does. But this is the liability, of course, is when you go along to get along, when something really weighty, morally weighty, theologically weighty is at stake. And so then it becomes, you know, what the mob wants rather than what God wants. I think about this a lot, Rich, and I mentioned it, I think, a few times on the air. Mark 15:15, easy to remember, okay, I think, 15:15, right? Well, what's going on there is at the end of the Gospel of Mark, and Jesus is tried before Pilate. And Pilate knows he's innocent. He's trying to get him off. And so he's trying to appeal to the mob in some way. What has this man done? Whatever. And then he realizes, well, I can let somebody go. Okay, here's Barabbas, and here's Jesus. Who do you want? And so the people call for Barabbas. And what do we do with Jesus? We crucify him. And so then the text, and this is 15:15, it says, wishing to please the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas, and he had Jesus scourged and crucified. Mm-hmm. Now, that is a haunting line for me, wishing to please the crowd. There are times when you go along kabuki style or whatever that means to just, you know, smooth things out where you don't need to make waves because nothing important is at stake. Yeah. Nothing wrong with that. It's a social grace. Mm-hmm. There's other times when everything is at stake on the issue. Mm-hmm. And this, what we're talking about I'm writing on it right now for the next Solid Ground in January, February, March coming out. I call it the primal heresy because this thing we're talking about goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 3. Mm-hmm. Who's in charge? Who rules? And the inside ruling versus the outside ruling, God's objective outside true world in that sense, or the inside true subjective thing. And this is all about the inside subjective thing. And since this is the thing that's driving the choices that young people are making, it's driving them, then this to me, even if they believe otherwise, and I get back to I don't want to get too far astray from this point, it's terrible when they are deeply, profoundly committed to themselves more than they are to God. I mean, the center mm-hmm. of their worldview is what pleases them, not what pleases God. But even if God's the center and they are talking like this to kind of go with the crowd, it seems to me now they're on Pilate's side. You know, they are siding with Pilate and not with Jesus, in the public discussion mm-hmm. at least.
Yeah.
And that is not a very good place to be.
Yeah, I mean, I keep coming back to this, but, you know, in a sense, it's disconcerting, but in a sense, when you take into account the environment that they're in, it makes a lot of sense, you know, because they're just, they got this coming at them 24/7.
You mean it makes sense in the way it's predictable? Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
You understand how that?
Yeah.
Okay, go
exactly,
ahead.
Exactly. Yeah, thanks for that clarification. So it's something that I think as teachers and educators and parents we need to combat against and be aware of. But it's not like we can wag our finger at the kids mm-hmm. because, you know, if I was in their shoes, I would be the same way. I'd probably be worse. And, you know, when I was in their shoes, when I was in high school, I was that way, and I didn't have 10% of the influences that they have.
Yeah.
You know, so they've, for all of the ways that life is more comfortable now than it ever has been, this is really a unique challenge. It's really a hard challenge for them to face. You know, I'd be really surprised if I found a student that was an independent thinker in the good sense. You know, it'd be really surprising given our culture.
Well, you know what? And I'm glad you said this too, because I think that the kind of moral courage that we are talking about that allows somebody to stand up the way Martin Luther King did, or a whole host of moral heroes and moral reformers that we have in mind, that kind of courage is something that's developed over time.
Right.
And it usually is not there very much in high schoolers,
mm-hmm.
At least in this day and age. Now, 100 years ago, so-called teenagers were in a whole different mental place than they are mm-hmm. now, a lot more mature. You know, kids don't grow up faster these days. What happens is they get grown-up privileges faster without the grown-up responsibilities, mm-hmm. so they get corrupted is what ends up happening.
Yeah.
But I think that this tempers just my own thinking. You can only expect so much, but this, I think the application here, Rich, for me is it makes it so much more incumbent on me as an adult having some role of responsibility
yes.
over children, young people, to want to encourage them in their courage and their confidence mm-hmm. in the right thing and a willingness to do the right thing. So we talk about a standard reason, a confidence for every Christian, clear thinking for every challenge, and courage and grace for every encounter. I had to pause mm-hmm. to think and get it right. But those are all part of what we're trying to do at Stand to Reason. And it just helps to be reminded of how critically important that is for us as adults to be instilling that in the children,
yeah.
what you're doing too with your students.
Yeah. If I ever get a chance to talk to parents in the church, and I say, look, church every Sunday and youth group every Wednesday is not enough. I was talking to a youth pastor this past Sunday. I did a role play at his church, and we were kind of talking afterwards. He's like, you know what, man, I got these kids for an hour and a half a week.
Mm-hmm.
The secular system not only has them for 8 hours, 5 days a week, but, you know, through their phones, it's just multiplied. So it's just a matter of math, you know. So that's the church every week and youth group. That's vastly important. You know, I think a lot of parents, like when church conflicts with a junior's soccer game on Sunday, they'll go to junior's soccer game instead
right.
of church. And that speaks volumes, not mm-hmm. good.
Haven't been able to do that this last year, though.
Yeah. But
now they're forced to stay at home, which gets them out of church in many cases.
Right.
Back to a screen.
Right,
even do
right.
so-called church on a screen.
Right. But, my point is that it doesn't stop there. You know, mm-hmm. so somebody is going to catechize your kids in
right.
2021. Do not mm-hmm. outsource that role.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's lots of ways to do that, but you've got to educate yourself. Don't pretend like you don't have the time, because you do. And if it's enough of a priority, you'll make room. And then, you know, find ways to talk with your kids. Find ways to get some true blue deep formation of your kids in every day, and do it for the long haul. If they complain about it, who cares? They're your kids, not the other way around. And just take their discipleship seriously, because if you don't, somebody else will. And I just think that a lot of parents underestimate the, you know, I don't say this to bring despair or anything, but
mm-hmm.
I'm hopeful but not optimistic. That's how Rod Dreher puts it.
Okay,
you just gotta realize the depth of what your kids are facing, and do not let them be catechized by don't outsource that role.
Let me backtrack a little bit to something we were talking about earlier, and that is how even with Christian kids, what ends up forming or seems to be informing many of their views or their decisions is this this individual, expressive individualism. You know, it's all about me and what I want. And this was a great insight in what you wrote, I thought, though it's dark. And that is, oftentimes, and I'm not painting a broad picture here, but oftentimes what is going on then with young people who are deeply socialized to this narcissistic, let's call it what it is, view of reality, that they are the center of everything and satisfying and their individual desires and fulfilling their individual plans and purposes is the most important thing, that when they are in Christian environments, it turns out that a lot of times they're doing the Christian thing because it, not because it's true, but in the objective sense, but because it satisfies their own personal expressive individualism, except when you bump into something in classical Christianity that's at odds with that, mm-hmm. like, for example, the sexual ethic, and then it's out the window.
Right.
And right, so these behaviors, even these religious kind of behaviors that seem like evidencing a good spiritual life, turn out to be just religious expressions of expressive individualism. Is that a fair way of putting it, or am I overstating it, do you think?
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that. I think the way that I put it is there's just kind of a like a bifurcated reality, like a secular sacred way of operating in the world. So when they go to church or they go to youth group, you know, they'll kind of put on the Jesus coat. But then when they go to class in their school, you know, maybe they'll let students know that they're a Christian or that they're evangelical or they're pro-life or whatever. But then they'll kind of say the same things that everybody else is saying. And like in our class discussions, it's uncanny the amount of agreement. Like if one person will start off the discussion saying one thing, everybody else is kind of like, yeah, I agree. And it's really rare to get, unless I push for it, you know, some substantial disagreement.
It's like a herd mentality there once it gets going.
Yeah.
Is that right?
And you know, the even the Christian kids, like I was saying, there's kind of like this understood tacit regime that mm-hmm. even though it's unspoken, nobody explicitly, you know, sits down and says, all right, here's what you're going to think. Like everybody just kind of understands, like this is
how it works.
Yeah, this is how it works. This is kind of the right thing to say. And so
what really surprised me is you described when you would do videos of debates or something, and I guess mm-hmm. you had William Lane Craig and Chris Hitchens that debate. You had a debate I had with on relativism with the professor from the University of Toronto, John Baker, and what
we
you
just
said
that
was,
today.
Which is what.
We just watched it today for a new semester. So.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yep.
But what was really interesting about what you wrote is that sometimes people would draw the opposite conclusion from the debater. I thought like Greg was really great and he made good arguments for relativism or something like that when I was arguing exactly the opposite. What's going on there? Is that their inability to really follow the line of thinking? Or
I think a little bit. And it goes back to what I was saying earlier. They just haven't really had many opportunities to think about a lot of this and to dialogue with it and kind of really wrestle with especially views like moral realism or mm-hmm. anything like that. So, yeah, man, that's super funny. And I every time I show that debate or every time I have them read something from a moral realist or something, there's always a few kids in the crowd that will take that and will reinterpret it to be a defense of moral relativism.
Of their own view.
Yeah. So I had them read Justin McBrayer's piece. He wrote something in the New York Times a few years ago called Why Our Children Don't Believe in Moral Facts. Mm-hmm. And it was a defense of moral facts. Pretty square, okay? Pretty lays it on pretty thick. And then after we read that, one of the students spoke up. He's like, oh, man, I really like what that guy had to say. Like, morality is just an opinion. Is there's like, how do you know that you're right? You don't. So it's just all this, you know, opinion. And I pointed out to him that he was defending the exact opposite, that there are moral facts. And he was just so surprised, you know, he's like, really? No, man, I don't agree with that. That's a bunch of junk. So it happens
so funny
a lot.
That that John Baker debate, I remember it well, and it did not, it just didn't go well for John Baker. And he was older, you know, and not in his prime, whatever, but I remember the atheists coming up, who the ones who sponsored him, chose him, and apologizing to me. They didn't want to believe my view. They wanted to blame the apparent success of my side of the discussion on the fault of, on the ineptitude or whatever of the person that they chose in the debate. Mm-hmm. But the point I'm making is, if the atheists thought it was one-sided, at least the way it appeared from where they sat at the debate, it's especially stunning to me that the students at least couldn't even comprehend the points I was making, or at least they didn't see them to be compelling, you know. And and I think that the argument or the debate, moral objectivism versus moral relativism, is so completely one-sided as far as the merits go. Partly because of the force of the problem of evil in people's thinking, because everybody knows something's wrong with the world, but there can't be something wrong with the world if morals are relative.
Yeah.
You know, and so maybe they just didn't put two and two together, they didn't connect the dots or what.
I don't know. I think it has a lot to do with, I think they implicitly recognize, maybe not explicitly, but implicitly, that moral realism or objective moral facts, that's a limit to their autonomy. And that would be some sort of fence post that would kind of hem them in if they acknowledged it. So,
mm-hmm.
In our discussions after the morality debate, students, I mean, it's one thing to hear you, Greg, tell a story about how you're getting adjusted at a chiropractor and you're having this conversation moral relativist. But it's another thing to actually... you're like me having this conversation and having students say that with a straight face and not blinking.
They don't get it. They don't see the problem, right?
Even to when it comes to like the George Floyd killing, you know, I've used that as a hot button in conversations mm-hmm. before. And, the one story that I'm thinking of in my head, that she didn't blink. She was like, yeah, it's not really true that what Derek Chauvin did is wrong. Like that's a consequence of my view. And like, there was no like, oh, good question, maybe I should think about that. It was just like, yeah, you know.
Well, it was wrong for her from her perspective, but she totally relativized mm-hmm. her judgment of it.
Yeah.
So I want to say we just got about 10 minutes. This whole hour has just blitzed by. And thank you for staying a little longer here
than we
either intended, but this has been fascinating for me. I want you to say something about dogmatism.
Yeah.
And I want you to say something about screens.
Okay, sure. I guess let me tell a story that I think would be good story time here. You mentioned that we had watched a debate on God's existence. So that's near the end of the semester. And the question that we're tackling is, you know, the ultimate question: to whom or what do we owe our existence? And so I have them watch the Hitchens versus Craig debate. And William Lane Craig does an excellent job, about 45 minutes plus or minus, giving evidence. You know, really good deductive argument, scientific evidence. Mm-hmm. You know, he's no slouch. And so after the debate, we're discussing, and the first few students to talk, and then everybody else agrees, just kind of up and just dogmatically said there's no evidence. And it's not like they're disagreeing with the evidence or that they reject the evidence. That would be fine. You know, I'm okay with that. But they just, after hearing 45 minutes of evidence, just dismissed it all with a hand wave and said, no, there's no evidence. And so I said, well, wait a second. You just heard 45 minutes worth of evidence. It's one thing if you don't think the arguments are good. You know, if you don't think the arguments are good, then tell me how. But you just dismissed it all in a hand wave. You know, what's up with that? And they're just like, yeah, no evidence. And so I said, okay, well, What would count as proof? What would count as evidence for you? What would be good? What would be good enough? And I said, well, it'd be cool if he appeared to me, or you know, showed me a miracle or something, or wrote his name in the sky. So I was like, well, that's kind of unfair, isn't it? Like that's you don't subject any of your other beliefs, even any of your other extraordinary beliefs,
right,
to that sort of standard. And you know, you're a modern person, so I'm pretty sure that if you saw a miracle or if God appeared to you, that you would write that off as, you know, something you had for lunch.
Yeah, you wouldn't go to God, you'd go to a psychiatrist.
Yeah, you would just keep you would not pay attention to that miracle. And they're just like, again, what can you do? And even a Christian kid spoke up saying, you know, nobody ever sees demonstrations now. I said, nobody.
Miracles, you mean?
Yeah. Well, he said demonstrations. That was his word. Oh, he meant miracles, yeah. So I was like, well, nobody? That's kind of dogmatic, don't you think? Like, how could you say something like that? You're 16, kid, you know? he's like, well, you know, I have never seen one, and my friends have never seen one. So I was like, all right, you know, maybe you should get out more, you know?
Yeah,
so that's kind of what I mean by dogmatic, you know? Even after hearing a very good explication of the contrary view and a lot of evidence and a lot of arguments.
Right.
There's not a whole lot of wrestling with it. And, you know, you can kind of tell if they're wrestling, and you can also tell if they dismiss it. And far too often, you know, I don't know. Maybe the hope is that, like you say, that you're putting stones in shoes. So when they walk away, maybe they're not defending turf anymore and they'll kind of chew on it a little bit more.
I get you there. But still, the resistance to even acknowledge, and I do hear this a lot, I've talked about it on the air, you know, no evidence. There's a difference between having no evidence and not having conclusive evidence. They're not even making that distinction.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a sweep of the hand, like you said, and dismissal of whatever's been said. No evidence.
Yeah.
So, amazing. Yeah. Okay, screens. You had a lot to say about screens in your piece. You kept coming back to it, and I want to hear it because I think it's important for our listeners to hear from you.
Yeah, I think just a lot of people really underestimate the degree to which screens disciple our young students and our sons and daughters. You know, I just see it everywhere. You know, when I was doing the role play this Sunday, after the role play, I was making this point, and I said, look, guys, don't tell me you're fine, because I'm a high school teacher. I've been around the block for a little while. I see it every day, and I saw it during worship today. Some of you, you know, you guys are addicted. Don't tell me you're not. The screens are, I just keep coming back to this word. They're a discipler. They're a catechizer. It's not a neutral tool. You know, I've heard pastors and well-meaning parents say, you know, it's just a neutral tool. It's just how you use it. That's what matters. Well, no, it doesn't. You can technically not be exposed to any anti-Christian ideas at all through screens, and it can still be discipling you in thoroughly unbiblical ways just because of the nature of the tool. I think it was Winston Churchill who said that we shape our buildings, and then our buildings shape us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true to the nth degree with screens, just because of, you know, they're like little heroin needles in your pocket. Mm-hmm. You know, these social media companies and screen companies pay a lot of people millions of dollars to make sure that your eyes are glued to that screen as much as possible.
Yeah, it's and like that documentary, The Social.
Exactly. Yes.
What is it called? The Social.
Social Dilemma.
Dilemma. People
and
ought to watch that.
And they're really, really good at it.
Mm-hmm.
So even though you're not, go ahead, Greg.
I was going to say, it also reinforces the idea that it's just me.
Exactly.
It's me alone having this experience about me and what I want to watch, when I want to watch it, how I want to watch it.
The ultimate good is maximizing choice.
Yeah.
You know?
By the way, I have a 13-year-old daughter who is going to, she's in eighth grade in a classical Christian school. She's been there for 8 years, and she's on a very good Christian trajectory, and I think it's authentic. But it is not unusual for her to say, kind of in a joking way, but she'll throw it out there, don't judge me. Don't judge me. I mean, this is a slogan that gets tossed around a lot, like judgment itself is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it's convenient for her, she'll throw the slogan out. So she's even been socialized to use the slogan, even though she's not a relativist when it comes to morality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the impact, the corrosive impact of the culture, even in my own daughter's life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I will probably have to talk about this off the air, because we're winding down now. But you said that you've divested yourself of a phone that does anything more than you can get text, you can get your emails, you can call on the phone, but you can't get apps, you can't get internet access, none of that other stuff.
Yeah,
I don't know what kind of phone that is, but that's the phone I want to get for my daughters.
It's an iPhone, but I've just figured out how to lock it down and throw away the key. to where I can't get at anything.
All right. Well, I'm going to have to find that out from you because my daughters have iPhones and we've been wanting to kind of do that. But is an act of parental protection for our children. But you have done that for yourself.
Yeah.
Knowing how vulnerable you are to the same thing, right?
Yeah. There's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, first off, I'm such the oddball at church. I'm such the oddball at work. You know, I'm like the weird guy with the phone. Like when I tell people I don't have internet access, like I get such weird looks. But anyway, first it was for me because I realized social media is so doggone toxic and it's not making anything better. And so I realized that was the case in my life and I had to do something. Mm-hmm. And these things just, they exert too much of a pull on us. And I knew that I wouldn't be able to resist if I didn't do that.
We got 30 seconds.
Okay, I got it. So the second reason was for my kids. Is because I know that I set the example for them. And so if I talk to them about, you know, social media and all this stuff, but then they see me all day long taking little Facebook snacks in the here and there and the little nooks and crannies of the day, that's going to speak volumes to them more than anything I say. Mm-hmm. And so I just had to set the example for them because I care about them more than I care about any sort of posturing on social media.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rich, let me just say it's been a treat to kind of renew our friendship here a little bit because we see each other like every 4 or 5 years, it seems, that we run into each other. I'm thrilled to see the way that you are paying it forward from what J.P. Moreland and the whole crowd over Talbot gave you and the things you pick up from STR, and you're making a difference in the lives of the young people there. And I'm just completely fascinated by your observations here that have been so helpful to me and our team here. I'm going to have them all read the stuff you sent me with your permission because I want them to have a clear picture of what we're up against and how we need to, as Paul says, having done everything to stand firm for us as adults and to teach our kids to do the same thing. So got to run here, Rich, but thanks so much. It's great to see you again, buddy.
Right back at you. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Okay, maybe we'll do it again. Rich Bordner. And friends, that's it. My music is up, and man, did that go fast. Thank you so much for joining us this hour. We got callers on board. We'll get to them next hour on Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kokel. Give them heaven.